This is Popular Front, a podcast focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict with me, Jake Hanrahan. Today we're speaking to journalist Jeff White. We're going to be talking about North Korea's cyber war. Believe it or not, North Korea has a very serious hacking team. They've been causing disruption to South Korea and various other countries across the world, also stealing lots and lots of money, specifically in cryptocurrency, and funneling it all back to the Kim Jong-un regime. It's a very interesting, underreported topic. Jeff's going to explain it to us. If you like what we're doing, please support us at patreon.com/popularfront. I think a lot of people don't immediately think of, you know, high-tech hacking when it comes to North Korea. And basically, it turns out that, yes, there is a very apt, like very well skilled hacking group in North Korea, and they go by the name the Lazarus Group, right? Maybe before we go into like the history and how this all started, maybe you could just explain to us, what is the Lazarus Group?
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, the Lazarus Group themselves probably don't refer to themselves as Lazarus Group. Yeah. That's the name they've been given by others. But they are, according to security researchers, North Korea's government hackers. It's fair to say most countries now, well, the vast majority of governments have computer hackers working on their behalf. We certainly do in the UK. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, given it's an incredibly militaristic society, North Korea has a group of government hackers. What makes them slightly different is the way they act, the way they operate, and their objectives, which is often, as we'll probably see in the course of the interview, to try and steal cash to prop up the North Korean regime.
Right, and in recent years, they've gone deep into stealing money from cryptocurrency exchanges and places like that and scamming. But they didn't start off like that, right? How did they come about? When were they first kind of noticed?
Well, Lazarus Group's been around for quite a while, more than 10 years. I think it goes back to 2008, 2009. People started to see traces that there was one particular hacking group who were active, and it was mainly South Korea at that point that they were targeting. Some other countries as well, but obviously, you know, North and South Korea, very, very long sworn enemies, still technically at war. A truce has been declared, but never the peace. And so South Korea became a kind of target for North Korea's computer hacking. It's fair to say, I'd imagine South Korea were trying their best to get into North Korea's networks as well, as lots of other countries do to each other. But North Korea's attacks got increasingly aggressive against South Korea. And I think the thing that really kicked it off among the cybersecurity community, but not the general public, was the Dark Seoul attacks in 2013, Seoul being obviously the capital of South Korea. And this was a series of attacks on banks and also TV stations. It did take some of the TV station systems offline. I don't know whether it took the TV stations offline, but certainly they had big trouble inside those TV stations. And the banks, some of them actually stopped issuing cash. The cash points went down, payment systems went down. What made this different was that up until then, North Korea's attacks had been the kind of stuff that was going on a lot around that tail end of the 2000s, rather, which was a defacement attacks. You know, hacker groups would hit a website, take the front page offline, put some stupid message on or some insulting message. That was a sort of level. Those 2013 attacks, which got attributed in the end to the Lazarus Group, were destructive attacks. Suddenly they're not just, you know, leaving insulting messages and taking websites offline. They're actually taking finance and media offline. And that's a big thing. In a democracy, you rely on two things, don't you? Information and money. and suddenly the North Koreans had hit both simultaneously. And that really put them on the map, that 2013 attack.
Right. And what was their aim there exactly? Was it just to mess with South Korea as much as possible, disrupt everything? Was it part of like a bigger plan, do you know?
There was certainly an element of disruption being a kind of type of psychological warfare. I mean, South Korea by this point had become one of the most, and still is one of the most technically advanced societies, countries in the world, very, very high tech. And I think part of North Korea's message was to say, look, you know, we can, in the way that asymmetric warfare works, we can use your advantages to our advantage. You know, your very essence of your high tech society can become your Achilles heel. The other thing that was interesting about that attack in 2013 was when researchers started looking back at where those viruses had appeared elsewhere in South Korea, they found them inside South Korean military networks, where they were being used to pull out intel from South Korean military units. And very, very targeted stuff, South Korean military movements, US military presence in South Korea. And what that indicated was A, that they were targeting the military, but B, what it also told the researchers was that in the same way they'd taken banks and TV stations offline in 2013, the North Korean attackers could have disabled military networks and military computers, but they didn't. And I suspect there's a calculus going on there in terms of, you know, if you switch the military's computers off in South Korea, you know, is that a step towards warfare? So they stopped short of how hard they could have hit South Korea, according to the researchers who looked into it.
Right, and that's all incredibly difficult for hackers to do. When you look at North Korea, obviously, you know, it's a totalitarian dictatorship. Most people don't have any access to the internet or anything like that, anything other, even on the TV, they only get the state media. How is it then that North Korea ended up with a group of essentially elite hackers?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, we sort of take it for granted in places like the UK that you can go out, you can get an internet connection, a phone and laptop if you've got the money, and just sort of get on with it, you know. And that's how a lot of hackers in the UK get their start. You know, they go on these little dark web forums and these little kind of nebbish forums and they learn how to hack. Mm. If you're in North Korea, if you have a computer and you have an internet connection, you've got it because the government gave it to you. There is no such thing as sort of freelance, if you like, internet surfing in North Korea. So it's incredibly rigidly controlled. And that's a bit of a problem for North Korea because, you know, in the UK, we can rely on our youngsters' natural inquisitiveness and, you know, laptop usage to effectively, you know, create the next set of computer hackers. In North Korea, the government has to actually train these people and spot them. So from an early age, they're trying to spot mathematically talented kids in school. They're trying to sort of groom them, those kids, and put them into the computer classes. And when those kids show promise in computing, they get sent to elite universities. From there, the really gifted computer kids will either go into the nuclear research program, which is very computer heavy, or into computer hacking for the state. And so that's the process by which they become very skilled. I mean, what's amazing, you know, talk to tech security researchers about this. What's amazing about North Korea's hackers is they start from scratch. Other hackers, you know, places like the UK, the US, they'll borrow. They borrow code from here, they borrow code from there. Right. They're never reinventing the wheel. North Korea's hackers often start from first principles. They write their own code in a very, very hands-on way. It's sort of like somebody, you know, building a new bicycle by forging the steel first, you know, forging the steel tubes and then welding them together, as opposed to me and you making a bike where we get a frame and a few wheels and we stick it all together. We're not starting from scratch. Mm. North Korea's hackers are often starting from scratch, and that makes them really interesting and weirdly easier to spot, perhaps, than they might be.
Does that make them, I don't know, I want to say like better at what they're doing, because I know there are very skilled hackers from the West as well. But do you think that makes them, I guess, like, you know, unique in that sense? Are they able to get into systems thinking outside the box, thinking differently or whatever?
It's a really interesting question. The way they get in is depressingly the way most computer hackers get in, which is sending phishing emails, phishing messages through social media. So the way in is fairly standard. The sort of computer viruses that they deploy, they are on the cutting edge. You know, they do develop some really interesting tools. So this is skipping forward in time slightly, but there was a ransomware attack in 2017 called WannaCry, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners will remember, hit the NHS disproportionately in the UK. Now, that virus was actually based on virus codes written by the US government that leaked out of the US government and then ended up on the sort of cyber black market. Now, North Korea's hackers, it's alleged, picked those viruses up and then weaponized them and unleashed them back on the world. So North Koreans are very adept at looking at what's the latest thing, what's the latest code that comes out and utilizing it. The disadvantage, or at least the bit they're not so good at, it seems from my working on them, is covering their tracks. A lot of computer hackers will destroy the evidence, cover their tracks. The North Koreans do that, but not to the extent they could. And I think there's two reasons for that. Partly, they think, well, I'm in North Korea, you know, you can't catch me. I've got no problem with you knowing who I am because you'll never be able to put me behind bars. And secondly, I think there is an element with North Korea and its hackers of wanting to exert not just hacking power on the world stage, but sort of influence power. You want to leave a hallmark, you want to leave a calling card, because then, frankly, people like me, journalists like me, talk about, you know, the hacking that you've done. So there's a sort of a PR game at play, I think.
What kind of signs are there that this was a hack via North Korean hackers?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. There is no, let's face it, there's no sort of handwritten note by Kim Jong-un saying, you know, right, I hacked you, ha ha ha. So you rely on various things. Firstly, there's the sort of the type of the targeting. When the attacks hit South Korea, you know, so violently in 2013, it was hard to imagine who else would have been motivated to have done that. You know, South Korea, I'm sure, has other countries that are interested in Intel, but countries that are interested in taking it offline and, you know, really damaging it. North Korea is the prime suspect there. So that's one, you know, sort of smoking gun, if you like. The other thing that's interesting is North Korea has a tiny window to the internet. So places like the UK will have millions, maybe even billions of IP addresses leading out in the UK, doorways to the internet. North Korea only has a very thin pipeline to the internet, and it's one of the most surveilled pipelines in the world, because obviously everybody wants to know what North Korea is up to. So when North Korea's hackers hack, if ever they use connections from inside North Korea, that is a real smoking gun. And in various cases have been investigated by the US, notably. They've found links back to IP addresses from within North Korea. That is a really compelling piece of evidence. You could say, well, hang on, maybe somebody, I don't know, set up shop in North Korea on a computer and is pretending to be North Korean. Well, you'd have to get into North Korea to do that, and you'd have to get online, and you'd have to start hacking. It's a really, really repressive society. It's really difficult to understand how somebody could fake a presence in North Korea from a technical perspective. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. So when those IP addresses lead back to North Korea, the assumption is these are North Korean hackers, therefore government hackers, inside North Korea.
Yeah. Do you have any idea what kind of scale these teams are? Like how many people perhaps, I know it's probably impossible to tell, but do you theorize perhaps are like working on this stuff at any one time?
It is a really good question. And there's the main source of information on that is defectors who come out of North Korea. It's worth noting that there've been quite a few military defectors, some of whom have been tangentially connected to the North Korean sort of hacking part of the military. But as it stands, I don't think we've had, and my co-host for the podcast, the Lazarus Heist is a book now, was a podcast originally. And my co-host Gene Lee for that podcast has been trying to find, you know, a North Korean hacker defector. As far as we're aware, that there aren't any, or at least there aren't any speaking. So working out, you know, the mechanics inside those hacking units is difficult. It's reported that it's 6,000 people. Jeez. That's been a figure that's been bandied about. Yes, but think of that. I mean, North Korea is a militaristic society. So most people in, you know, most young people, certainly North Korea, end up in the military. Is that 6,000 hackers or is that just 6,000 military staff on computers assisting?
Quite small then.
Well, yeah, I mean, UK has places like RAF Corsham, I think, where, you know, there's lots of signals intelligence stuff goes on. Obviously, you have GCHQ, you know, you're looking into the hundreds, maybe even the thousands there. As I say, what makes North Korea's hackers different is this financial motivation they've got that's led them into all these really interesting, really impactful hacks, but has also led them into working with organized crime in a really interesting way. That's not something almost any other government hackers have ended up doing.
Right, well, they kind of moved on from that, right? So you were saying they attacked South Korea, messing with their infrastructure, stuff like that. That obviously, I don't know, for want of a better word, got patched up. It became harder for them to do things like that. But then they moved on, like you say, to crime. Maybe talk us through that. How do they go about that? And, you know, to what ends?
The sort of backdrop to this is obviously, again, a lot of your listeners will know this, but North Korea, thanks to its belligerent missile and nuclear testing regime, has been subject to international financial sanctions. And in about, I think it was 2014, I'm going to say, the United Nations restricted North Korea, again, thanks to missile tests, restricted it from access to international financial markets. It's just very difficult to work out how North Korea could sort of cope financially as a country. The stuff other countries do, buying and selling stuff, North Korea can't do that, can't provide services, no one's allowed to pay them. So North Korea is just sealed off, but keeps limping on as an economy, you know, somehow keeps trucking. And so the question became, how do you do that? The accusations from the United Nations now and the US government is that they've turned to cybercrime. They've committed crime before. There's been a long history of drug dealing, of counterfeiting, smuggling, illegal trade, and so on. And cybercrime just sort of merged into that and become the next thing that North Korea's kind of criminal regime ends up doing. And so they've been targeting banks around the world, some very, very big banks for some very big amounts of money. And as you say, cryptocurrency firms and stealing from them. That's probably the biggest example, the one we cover in the book and did cover in the podcast, is the hack on Bangladesh Bank, which was an attempted $1 billion theft.
Right, and they actually got a lot of money from that as well, if I remember.
Yes. They went after $1 billion from Bangladesh Bank through a series of quite random sort of slip-ups and errors and coincidences. What they actually got out at the end of the day was, we think, about $81 million. That's not as much as a billion, obviously, but it's still quite a lot of money. For someone like North Korea, you know, every cent counts. But as I say, I mean, those amounts from Bangladesh Bank, that 81 million is dwarfed by the amount they've stolen from cryptocurrency exchanges over the years. That's estimated at something like $2 billion.
Right. And there was a really interesting bit I was reading in your book about the way they kind of cash out, the way they launder this money. It was real kind of grassroots, if you like, you know, like on the ground type stuff. Maybe you can explain that to us, how they managed to then get the money.
Yeah, that's right. So the Bangladesh Bank example is the sort of classic one. They broke in, they hacked into the bank. They got access to a thing called the SWIFT terminals within Bangladesh Bank, which, thanks to the conflict in Ukraine, a lot of people know a lot more about SWIFT than they did before. But SWIFT is how banks move money from one bank to the other. So once you've got access to a bank SWIFT terminal, you can basically just say, please transfer $1 billion to, you know, my account. You can effectively clean out the vault by making a transfer through SWIFT. Of course, the snag there is, which account do you transfer it to? So if you transfer it to Jake Hanrahan's account, it's going to be obvious that you did it.
Yeah.
It's a really dumb move. So what you need then is accounts through which to wash the money. So in the Bangladesh Bank example, they'd set up accounts in the Philippines, in Manila. And one of the reasons they did that was when they broke into Bangladesh Bank, the account they were cleaning out that contained $1 billion wasn't actually in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. The account was in New York. So Bangladesh, the government, keeps an account in New York. So Bangladesh Bank is the national bank of Bangladesh, and it keeps an account in New York that's in dollars. So if Bangladesh wants to pay someone in America in dollars, they can just pay them out of their New York Federal Reserve Bank account. So that contains $1 billion. So the hackers go, okay, we're going to transfer that $1 billion out of New York, and we're going to transfer it into our accounts that we've set up in the Philippines. The reason this worked out very well for them was because the time zones worked really well. Bangladesh, again, some of the listeners may know this, the weekend runs Friday to Saturday, not Saturday to Sunday. So the hackers broke into Bangladesh Bank and started doing these transfers on Thursday night in Bangladesh. So Friday, they knew the bank was going to be skeleton staff, Saturday, skeleton staff. But when it's Friday and it's the weekend in Bangladesh, it's a normal Friday, working Friday in New York, which is where the money's held. So the New York Fed, where the money's held, just starts transferring it across to the Philippines. By the time they'd all transferred it across, the bank staff in Bangladesh came back in. It was Sunday after the weekend. Oh my God, the money's gone. What's happening? So they phone up the New York Fed. But no one's answering the New York Fed because it's the weekend. The money, meanwhile, is washing into the Philippines. Monday, the 8th of February 2016, in the Philippines is a bank holiday. So when the money arrives at the Philippines and finally Bangladesh Bank gets its act together and the Fed in New York get their act together and they phone up Manila in the Philippines, there's nobody answering the phones because, again, it's a bank holiday. So it's astonishingly well-timed and well-executed raid on the bank. Once the money goes into the accounts in the Philippines, you might think, well, that's, you know, it's game over. The hackers can just pull the money out and away you go. Well, not really, because the accounts in the Philippines have to be set up using IDs. They have to have bank account numbers. So the problem the hackers have got is if the money's in bank accounts, it can always be pulled back. You can always claw it back. Mm. What you need is to take the money out of the accounts in some way that the victim can never get it back. So that's exactly what they did in the Philippines. They drew out the $81 million that arrived there. They drew that money out and stuck it into casinos. Just to quickly alert your eagle-eared viewers, eagle-eared listeners might have noticed that we started talking about $1 billion, and then what I said was $81 million arrived in the Philippines. Well, the New York Fed spotted some of these transfers before they managed to go through. And the reason the New York Fed spotted them was because the bank branch in Manila that the hackers had set up to receive the money was in a place called Jupiter Street. Jupiter just happens, by dumb luck, to be the name of a sanctioned Iranian ship. Mm. And so when New York Fed got a transfer for money involving the word Jupiter, even though it has nothing to do with the Iranian case at all these transactions got flagged. And the New York Fed said, no, we're not going to transfer that money. So the only transfers that got through were the first few transfers, totaling $81 million. But that money was taken out of the bank in the Philippines, and the hackers took it to a couple of casinos in the Philippines, gambled the money over the casino tables. At that point, it's very, very difficult for investigators to trace the money that goes into the casinos to the money that comes out. Because, of course, when you get to the casino, you change your money for chips, you gamble your chips, you get a few chips back, take them, change them back into cash, walk out. very difficult to trace the money that went in to the money that went out. So you're right, it was proper old school Ocean's 11 cash in hand laundering. Absolutely astonishing. And it took weeks for that process to happen. Weeks and weeks and weeks.
Something that really fascinated me, I was really just stuck on it for ages, trying to find more info on it, was when you were talking about the way the pachinko machines are used by kind of pro-North Korean, you know, Yakuza criminal organizations to get the money back there. Is that right? That's how they do it?
Yeah, so there's a long history. So Japan obviously occupied Korea when before Korea became North and South Korea, it was just Korea. Japan occupied it at that point. A lot of Koreans, just Koreans as they were in those days, ended up in Japan. When North Korea gets split from South Korea, people back in Japan are a bit flummoxed by this because it's like, well, am I a North Korean? Am I South Korean? And that division really caused problems. People in Japan who are ethnically Korean, some of them don't really know which country they would go back to or should go back to. Some of them just want the country to be unified again. So anyways, big, big, big contingent of Korean people, some of whom would identify as North Korean, in Japan. There is still a lot of prejudice against Korean people in Japan. They struggle to get jobs some of the time. The community's been sort of isolated. And so the North Koreans in Japan have ended up sort of on the fringes of society and have ended up rubbing shoulders with the other people on the fringes of society who are, of course, criminals. And as you say, the Yakuza crime gangs in Japan. There are these little pachinko parlors in Japan. Again, some of your listeners have been there may know this. It's sort of gambling dens, kind of weird gambling operation. A lot of that is run by Yakuza crime gangs, and a lot of those are interacting with North Koreans in Japan. I don't want to paint a picture of all Koreans or North Koreans in Japan being into crime, but certainly there's a lot of links there that the police in Japan believe there's a big North Korean presence. And the money, I mean, God, the profits those pachinko parlors make, astonishing. That money can get fed back into North Korea and again can be used to prop up the regime. So that Japan gambling pachinko North Korea route is a well-worn route and a really interesting one. I found out how much the company that makes the pachinko machines make. It's astonishing. Millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, like Konami. They were like a huge video game company. And they make more money now from pachinko machines than their like original games. It's crazy.
Astonishing. And I find those so weird, those pachinko parlors. I mean, I don't gamble. I've just got no interest in gambling at all. But rows and rows of people sticking little metal balls into these machines to kind of win a prize at the end. And so you win a prize. The idea is you can't gamble in Japan for money, or at least very rarely for money. So what they're gambling for is yen or a slice of cake or whatever. But when you win that prize, conveniently, you walk around the corner and there's a shop that swaps your prize for cash. Oh, how convenient. So it's basically a way of disguising gambling for cash.
And when this money gets back to North Korea, I mean, it's kind of a dumb question, I guess. I guess they use it for the same things they usually use it for. But is there any indication of, you know, what they're spending this on? Is there any theories? Because it is a lot of money coming in. I know that they need the money because of sanctions and that. But do you know if it's like specifically going, I imagine a lot of it just goes to Kim Jong-un, like, you know, directly or indirectly.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. And, you know, this is the missing bit, really, in the picture that we've got. You know, from the evidence we've seen and people have presented, you know, I think a lot of people have no doubt that North Korea is stealing this money and stealing billions, as I say, notably in cryptocurrency. We also know that under Kim Jong-un, the missile tests and the nuclear tests have ramped up. And during the COVID period, seemed to keep going at a quite alarming rate. Now, you know, the sanctions have not given up. North Korea has not discovered a new legal way to make money. So, you know, the logical conclusion is that this stolen money ends up going to fund North Korea's nuclear and missile ambitions. The other thing is North Korea's got this military first policy, which it's had since the mid-90s. You know, money coming into the country goes to the military first. So, you know, by its own declaration, North Korea, you know, sounds likely to be spending this stolen money on the military first. But the other thing which I didn't realize, my co-host Jean is really good, Jean Lee, on North Korea. She spent years there as the AP bureau chief. She's a fascinating woman. And she sort of talked about, you know, the effort it takes to prop up the sort of cronies of the regime. I mean, they all need to be given a Mercedes, they need to be given some cognac, they need to, you know, pay off this person. So just propping those people up with sort of foreign acquired goods is a mission in itself. It's probably not as expensive as building missiles, but, you know, so you're right. There's a lot of it goes to sort of feather Kim Jong-un's nest to keep people around him sweet so that they don't get rid of him and overthrow him.
Jeez, it's just like, I mean, it really does sound like a spoiled child, you know what I mean? With so much power.
Yeah, I mean, there's stories about Kim Jong-un's childhood and the sort of pampered nature of it and him being given a kind of you know, military general's uniform at you know, at age five or something like that, and people saluting him. I mean, you know, you're brought up basically. It's a sort of monarchy. It's effectively a monarchy that they've got.
Did the kind of hacking empire get bigger under Kim Jong Un?
I'm going to say yes, even though, as I say, I can't put a figure on that and say, oh, it was 2,000 people, it's now 6,000. I mean, A, unassailably, the cadence of attacks, of hacks, I think has gone up. Mm. And what, as evidence of that, I point to the fact that this year we had a hack on a company called Axie Infinity, which is a video game. I'll be honest, even as a tech journalist, I've never heard of this game. It's huge. In Vietnam, it's absolutely massive, this game. It's like a cross between, you know, those Tamagotchis, the little things you used to keep alive. Yeah. The Tamagotchi animal you used to have to keep alive, a little digital animal, digital pet. It's like a cross between that and WWF wrestling. So you like you have a little Axie that you train and then the Axie fights other creatures. Anyway, apparently this is hugely popular. Hacked into, allegedly by the North Koreans, they stole $625 million from this company. I'm going to say this again. I've said it before and I'm still waiting for somebody to correct me on this. So I'm saying it's true. That is the single biggest hack from one victim in one hack ever. There isn't one that's bigger. And so, you know, if you talk about has it increased under Kim Jong-un, I think the answer to that is pretty obviously yes. He's also, and again, my co-host Gene talks about this, he's also, he paints himself as a sort of millennial leader, this kind of young, groovy leader. And so, you know, computers are his thing. And so for, you know, the government's computer hackers, they're pushing an open door to get more budget from him to do hacks, I suspect.
Yeah. And what kind of, do you have any idea what kind of hardware they have? I mean, I know that China, you know, a lot of stuff comes through China and whatever, and they have kind of close relations. But I was wondering, like, how do they... You would need a lot of good equipment, I would imagine.
Yes and no. I mean, you need a fairly powerful laptop to process, I'd imagine, some of the kind of data that they're getting. But, you know, you don't need a sort of supercomputer to do this kind of stuff. I mean, most of the hackers that I know work on fairly standard kits. Weirdly, a lot of them use Macs, but they use Macs running a sort of Linux software. So you don't necessarily need a sort of supercomputer to do it. In terms of the technology that's going into North Korea and that they get trained on, as you say, a lot of it comes in from China. It is then manipulated so that it can't be used to just access the general internet. So, for example, there's some really interesting research recently about phones and the Wi-Fi networks on the phones, because the phones have a Wi-Fi setting, so you can switch the Wi-Fi on the phone. But the only network it's program to connect to is the government network. So it's like, well, you have Wi-Fi and you can only connect to this network because the government doesn't want you connecting to anybody else's Wi-Fi. Similarly with tablet computers, the tablet computers are fitted, you know, with locked down operating systems, so you can't escape them. There's also spyware on a lot of the phones that are in North Korea. Apparently researchers have discovered that the phones take a screenshot of the screen every few seconds or every few minutes when you're using it, and those screenshots, I don't know whether they're uploaded to the North Korean government, but the North Korean government can check them when they, you know, they seize your phone in North Korea. So the whole technology from within North Korea is interesting. But of course, what I'm talking about there, the Chinese stuff, is the stuff that's available to sort of North Korean citizens if they have enough money, basically. The hackers that I'm talking about would almost certainly be given much better kit, decent modern laptops. If they didn't get them in North Korea, they would just get them when they go overseas to China, which is where they often end up hacking from.
And how close a relationship, if any, do you know that like North Korean hackers and Chinese hackers have? Because I know that China has its own complete industry of hacking as well.
That's a really good question. Somebody asked about that recently, and it's a gap in my knowledge. I don't know. As I say, I know that North Korea's been forming these alliances with organized crime, with sort of street-level crime. And we're talking about card fraudsters, we're talking about money mulers, that kind of thing. You know, your dudes in the casino in Manila. There's been a couple of reports of North Korean hackers ending up working with sort of Russian organized cybercrime gangs, which I suppose doesn't, you know, North Korea again has got a long history with Russia. Russian organized cybercrime is, you know, one of the most well-developed on the planet. In terms of the Russian, in terms of the Chinese collaboration, I don't know. It would make logical sense, but I haven't got any specific examples I can talk to. We do know that North Korean hackers have ended up in China, because obviously going over the border from North Korea into China isn't difficult. And obviously in China, you can hide in amongst their billions of IP addresses. So as I said, hacking from inside North Korea is a bit of a dumb move because you're going to get tracked back there. But if you hop over the border into China and you hack from inside China, you can work there. The other thing is North Koreans often end up with Chinese passports or can get Chinese passports. Mm. So it's possible that some of the hackers we thought were Chinese are actually North Korean. It's possible there's a lot more crossover. But you're right, it's a really, it made me think now. It's an area that I kind of need to get into and have a bit more of a look in because it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I was just wondering because they seem to, it seems to be their only friend really in the region, right?
Mm. But China has this interesting sort of push-me-pull-you relationship with North Korea. You know, when they want to be close to places like the US, they will talk tough on North Korea. If they want to kind of stretch the relationship with the US and, you know, get a bit of leverage, they sometimes cozy up and get a bit closer to North Korea. You know, opening and closing the borders, for example, cracking down on hackers, letting hackers go. You know, they use North Korea, as they have for a long time, as a sort of a bit of a useful bargaining tool, a bargaining chip for diplomatically speaking.
Yeah. So how did they then get into their kind of crypto theft circuit, if you like?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that goes back, we think sort of 2016 kind of time. So fairly early, not the very earliest days of crypto, started looking around at stealing from cryptocurrency exchanges. The advantage of cryptocurrency for not just North Korea's hackers, but all hackers, is if you think about the stuff I've talked about with that whole Bangladesh Bank example, you know, going through the New York Fed, getting the money into Manila, getting to the casinos, getting the dudes to gamble it in the casinos, carrying it out. You're talking about a very big logistical overhead there. And in some cases, heavy. I mean, you're talking the amount of cash they pulled out of the bank weighed as much as a grand piano. You're talking about trucks rolling across Manila to take the money in, you know, huge quantities of cash. Compared to that, cryptocurrency looks like a charm, doesn't it? Because you can type in a few letters, a few numbers, and away you go. Your cryptocurrency moves from one digital wallet to another in the blink of an eye. Also, it's international. You know, if the North Koreans want to pay, or indeed other cyber criminals, if they want to pay off somebody who's living in Argentina, well, they can just transfer them the Bitcoin there. If that person is in Malaysia, just transfer the Bitcoin there. So it's a sort of international, seamless bank account. So that's, I suspect, one of the reasons why North Korean cyber criminals got into it. There's also been, you know, apart from recent experience, the rise in value of things like Bitcoin. They do rise in value. And I suspect, despite the recent sort of problems, I suspect it will keep rising in value. And the third sort of factor to feed into this, beyond the sort of ease and beyond the rise in value, is coronavirus. When coronavirus started to kick in, getting all those money mules out on the street, recruiting money mules, you know, the casinos they would have used to launder that money, they all closed. So suddenly, in COVID times, cryptocurrency laundering and theft looks a lot easier to do than traditional money. So for all those reasons, that's kind of how they've ended up doing crypto. And that's just a general trend, as I say, in cybercrime.
And they were hitting up exchanges, if I remember right.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the obvious, it's the old bank robber quote, although he denied ever saying it. Why do you rob banks? Because it's where the money is. Cryptocurrency exchanges are where you sell your bitcoins for dollars and you pay dollars for bitcoin. So the money is washing through there. So it makes perfect sense. That's where you'd go if you want to try and steal the money. And again, in terms of the cryptocurrency exchange attacks, it's in the billions of dollars, the amounts of money that's been stolen. $2 billion is the estimate. That, for me, that is a vast, vast underestimate, because that number is taken of the amount that the cryptocurrency was worth at the time of the theft. Now, some of these hacks go back to 2016, when Bitcoin would have been $10,000 a coin. It's now, even in the slump, what, 20, 30? So that $2 billion figure is a huge underestimate. They're targeting cryptocurrency exchanges where people change regular money into crypto. They're also increasingly targeting individuals in the cryptocurrency community. And there's this bizarre story, I should have mentioned, we're doing another season of the podcast. It's going to be another season of the Lazarus Eyes podcast out later this year. And we're covering in that the bizarre story of North Koreans not only trying to hack into cryptocurrency exchanges, but trying to get jobs at cryptocurrency companies and doing job interviews to try and get jobs in these places. Presumably because once you're inside a cryptocurrency company, you can try and hack into it a lot easier than if you're outside. So they are now trying to sort of finagle their way into getting a career in cryptocurrency. It's absolutely astonishing.
There was a really interesting part in your book about that, actually, where I was wondering, I think it's where the guy is trying to get a job and he clearly doesn't have the skills and he's like keeps muting the guy that's interviewing him that works at the crypto exchange. He doesn't really know how to communicate. I was wondering, do you think that kind of, even with the kind of inner circle, it sounded to me like maybe North Korea's isolation meant they weren't that good at like social engineering, or do you think that's off? I don't know. I just from that exchange in the book, it felt like that guy just didn't know how to talk to people.
That's a really good question, and I don't think it's. I think it's one of these questions, which there are quite a few of in North Korea's case, where the answer isn't quite clear. I think there are people. Look, there are people definitely within North Korea's hacking infrastructure who are very good at social engineering. If you look at the attack on Sony, which we haven't actually talked about, 2014, North Korea's hackers broke into Sony Pictures Entertainment. It's believed to get revenge on Sony because Sony made this film called The Interview, in which Kim Jong-un is shown as being assassinated. Kim Jong-un, obviously being leader of North Korea, didn't go down well with him. In their attacks on Sony, the social engineering was very, very good, very astute, and it worked. They got into Sony. They were trying multiple different ways in. So one of the things they did was they contacted cast and crew who'd worked on the film, The Interview, and they said to them, Facebook messages they sent them saying, click here to download nude celebrities' photos. And this came a few months after there had been a huge leak of nude celebrities' photographs. And so the North Koreans obviously caught on that and thought, that's good. That's how you get people to click on a link, isn't it? Right, we'll use that. Mm. So some of them seem very, very adept. I mean, one of them who's been charged by the US, though never convicted, created an entire Bitcoin enterprise, recruited legal experts and technology experts around the world for this scam operation, and tricked all these people who thought they were working for a real company that was going to, you know, raise millions of dollars and, you know, be launched on the stock market. And he actually managed to trick all these people. The US's government's put out a photo of this kid. He looks about 12. It's insane. So some of them are very good. But like you say, some of them are just awful at this stuff. I mean, to get a job at a cryptocurrency company, which is what I was talking about just now, you've got to really know your stuff. You're doing a job interview. You've got to answer questions. You've got to perform. The idea that some guy in North Korea who won't even switch on his webcam and doesn't really speak English, let alone, you know, be able to answer any of the questions, the idea that person's going to get themselves a job at a crypto exchange is mad. Yeah. But they're giving it a go, bless them. You know, it's just, as you say, I just think there's a mix of abilities in terms of socializing generally and social engineering in particular.
It may be, I don't know, a bit of a naive Westerner thing to say, but it does make me wonder why there haven't been any like real hackers coming out. Because you would think if they do have access to the internet, okay, sure, I'm sure they have a nice life in North Korea, but you would think some of them would be like, hang on, they've seen the rest of the world. I get it, you know, North Korea often hangs on to their families and that sort of thing. But do you think there's something else to it? Do you think maybe they're just dyed in the wool, you know, brainwashed or whatever, supporters, or they're kind of at the mercy of the state?
Yeah, it's a really good one. Yeah, you're right. Of all the people in North Korean society, you would have thought the hackers might want to defect and be able to defect because they've seen what the outside world looks like. They've got internet connection, which most people in North Korea don't. They travel abroad. They can see what the foreign world looks like, the outside world looks like. They must know that the stuff North Korea says is nonsense. So you're right, this is a big question. Why don't they defect? And there's sort of multiple answers to that, one of which you picked up on already, which is often the family are still at home in North Korea. And if you defect from North Korea, your family's lives are made very, very difficult indeed. And that can stretch all the way from regular shakedowns from the police to being put in a prison where they then die. You know, the consequences for your family and your loved ones are potentially very serious. Secondly, if you do a good job as a hacker overseas for the North Korean government, I mean, there's a prestigious individual, it's a prestigious role, I think, to have in the military, from what I know of it. You know, when you go back home, you'll be sort of fated as a bit of a hero. You know, you went out, you hacked for the government. Here's your big apartment and your big telly and, you know, your cushy job within government. And compared to the hardship of normal North Korean society, that probably sounds pretty tempting. But the other thing that I just don't think you can discount is, I mean, you said brainwashing, it's probably the right word, but it's just impossible for you and I to put ourselves in the position of someone who's been raised from birth to believe that this is the greatest country on earth, North Korea, that the leader is the greatest person on earth, that this leader has almost mystical powers, that they are effectively the father country, and that the rest of the world is against you. It's almost impossible for us to put ourselves in that position. Yeah. And the sway of that to go, okay, I have to go back home. I belong to this country. That's inculcated in people from birth in North Korea. I think it's quite hard to get out from under that. So.
Yeah, something I was thinking about a while ago, like we have various, I mean, they only exist on the internet, but you get like white Western pro North Korea, you know, like extreme Stalinist types, and they, you know, they hate us and whatever, we hate them. But it's like when I've tried to talk to some of them just out of interest, And it's like, okay, you grew up in the West and you, I mean, not, I'm not saying like the West is the best, but you know what I mean? You've had freedoms, and they become brainwashed themselves kind of via the internet. And I think, wow, if you can become like that, like you said, God knows what it must be like growing up there. It's true. We have no idea. It's sad though. I think as well, like maybe just to kind of finish off, it'd be good for us to talk about, you know, the people that aren't hacking, right? Like most people are not living anywhere near a computer. They have no access to the outside world. Those people, it doesn't trickle down to them, right?
No, I mean, the vast majority of North Korea's 26 million people, you know, I doubt have ever, well, they might have seen tablets, maybe phones, but you know, the idea of seeing a computer that connects to the outside world, the internet, no. And there's this really interesting, I mean, there's a couple of stories about people who've been into North Korea and been into the computer labs, and there's this slightly Truman Show-esque aspect to it, where the North Koreans sort of put on a show of, oh, this is our computer lab where, you know, our students use computers to look at the internet. And what's been really interesting from the sort of testimony of the people who visited is the idea that the students, or at least the people they're told are students in the class, just show absolutely no interest in it. Mm. I mean, one of them said, you know, they're told to go to the internet and get a piece of information. They go to the internet, they get the piece of information, that's it. They have no, there's almost no inquisitiveness to go, oh, I wonder what's on this link, I wonder if I click that. That's just sort of not, that sense you and I have, you know, well, I don't know about you, when I first discovered the internet, you just click link after link, you go, oh, I wonder where this leads.
Yeah.
That just doesn't seem to exist, certainly in the testimony that I've heard. And so I do wonder whether this is sort of institutional aspect, institutionalized aspect to people where, and I think we'd have to be very careful about this. You know, let's imagine a future where Kim Jong-un no longer is the leader and suddenly North Korea opens up. You've got to be incredibly careful with a society of people who've been raised like that, who maybe don't have that inquisitiveness. If you suddenly hit them with the whole outside world and the whole internet, I don't know. I can't see that going well. I think we've got to be really, really careful with that. It's not something I've thought about this before, actually. But yeah, how would we deal with that? An entire isolated country, bringing them out of isolation, you can't just drop that on them. It's not going to go well, I don't think.
No, it's not. And it's like this thing of, oh, well, then, you know, if Kim Jong-un left, if he was gone and the regime was gone, then everyone would be fine again. It's like you said, it's like, well, no, you'd have to kind of re-educate millions of people. It would be an unbelievable culture shock, you know.
It really would, more than any other country in the world. I mean, I went to Cambodia. Well, when I was in Cambodia, I think Pol Pot was still alive. But, you know, that country was damaged still from, you know, decades before. These memories don't go away. And just North Korea, you've got to realize, is the world's oldest socialist country. It went socialist in 1948. And has been under one dynasty ever since. And has been getting, you know, it's, I mean, the fact Kim Jong-un's hung on is quite astonishing. It's remarkable. And the idea, you know, as I say, the idea that one day that country will open up. On the one hand, I want to be on the first plane out there. On the other hand, the idea of North Korea being deluged with foreign visitors, I'm starting to wonder whether that would be a good idea, much as I'd love to do it. You need what do you call it, when you come up from diving, you need decompression.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, God, I don't know how that would even work. As I say, I've not thought about this before, but it's an interesting thought experiment.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Is there anything else you want to say before we go about this?
No, just that the book's out now. It's called The Lazarus Heist, if you want to get it. And the podcast, as I say, series one was last year. It's all on the BBC or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And series two of that's going to be out later this year. We think October, November time. And all the stuff we talked about, the crypto stuff, the bonkers stuff with the organized crime, that's all going to be in series two. So it's all good stuff.
If people want to follow you on social media and, you know, find out more about your work, where can they do that?
Best way is probably Twitter. I'm Jeff White 247. So Jeff with a G, white like the color. And 247, because I am Jeff White, 24/7.
All right, mate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was journalist Jeff White talking to us about North Korea and their hacking teams that have been stealing money from all over the world, sending it back to the Kim Jong-un regime, and also causing various chaos to South Korea. Really interesting. I read Jeff's book in about 2 days. Definitely have a look at it, The Lazarus Project. This is not an advertorial or anything like that. I just read the book and I was like, yeah, this is sick. Contacted Jeff and he wanted to come on. It was all good. So yeah, check his podcast out as well. Also the same title, The Lazarus Project. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please do consider supporting us on the Patreon. We are completely independent, completely grassroots. patreon.com/popularfront. That's how we keep moving forward. That's how we make money to keep doing big projects as we've been doing with our documentaries. You'll see them at youtube.com/popularfront. For $5, $10, there's all sorts of extras only on the Patreon there. Patreon.com/popularfront. Also, another way to support us and look cool while doing it, you can buy our t-shirts at popularfront.shop. Most of the money that comes from the merchandise sales goes straight back into the documentary fund so we can go and make documentaries. Because we are censored on YouTube very heavily, we actually can't make a single penny from our documentaries. So we make £5,000 to £10,000 losses every single time we make a documentary. It's a fucking nightmare, but my point stands. We need funding the way we're going, and we are committed to staying grassroots, committed to staying independent. So yeah, definitely check us out. For all our links to everything, just go to popularfront.co/support. Also want to say a big shout out to everybody that came to the Clapton FC screening of Frontline Hooligan. Thank you so much. We raised quite a bit of money for Hoodswood's clan. That money is going back to them. If you're in Hamburg, Germany, on August 27th, there will be another screening. There will be information going out on the Popular Front Instagram and Twitter at various points before then, telling you how you can get a ticket. There will be limited spaces. The Clapton one sold out fast, so this one will probably sell out fast as well. So if you don't get a ticket, you know, that's kind of on you. Make sure you can get it when you can. All the money, again, all proceeds, all profits will be going to Hoodswood's clan. They're now on the front line fighting. It will be announced soon. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to Grindcore House, a pair of independent coffee shops in Philadelphia, USA. One in South, one in West. Find them on socials at Grindcore House. Drop into their shop. Tell them we sent you. You might get a free coffee or something like that. Also, you can stop in at our other sponsor, Oracle Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon, USA. They're an independent coffee business selling only fair trade products. See them at 3875 South West Bond Avenue, 97239. Drop in, maybe tell them Popular Front sent you, although somebody did that, and apparently the guy behind the counter was just like, okay. So I don't know why, but yeah, whatever. But yeah, have a look at them. And our other sponsor, Propagandopolis, an outlet selling and writing about historical conflict propaganda from around the world. You can buy prints at propagandopolis.com. Use a promo code PopularFront10 for 10% off. If you like what we're doing, again, please support us on the Patreon, patreon.com/popularfront. If you want to follow us on social media, Instagram is at popular.front, Twitter is at popularfront_. Again, youtube.com/popularfront for all our documentaries. We started a TikTok in a means to kind of push traffic from the TikTok to our YouTube channel, because like I said, YouTube is censoring us badly. And I was told that that's a way to do things. Within like a week, we got like 4 strikes. I think we get one more, we're fucking banned. So if you want, you can look at us, share our stuff on the TikTok. It's tiktok.com/@popular.front. So yeah, at popular.front. If you share our shit, remix it, do whatever the fuck you want, mock us if you want, it's all good, it's all the algorithm. Try that, maybe then we'll be able to post on there again. I don't fucking know, but we were basically just posting clips up on there from our documentaries. Again, oppressive fucking tech bro bullshit or CCP spy app in TikTok's case. But yeah, there we go. Check us out on the socials. If you want to follow me on anything, it's just at @Jake_Hanrahan, HANRAHAN. Music in this episode, the intro is by Home and the outro is by our music producer, Sam Black. You can listen to Sam's music at samblackpf.com or just search Sam Black PF in any music streaming platform. You'll find him there. We're on Spotify, Apple Music, all of that shit now. And we will be putting up a lot more music. We put some up there and then we got fucking smashed in the head by Spotify and all the rest of them for some copyright bullshit. So because of a sample so that we didn't, obviously weren't going to clear. So yeah, but yeah, you can look us up on there. Look up Sam's music. He's, you know, integral part of Popular Front. So definitely check it out. Samblackpf.com. Thank you very much to the higher tier patrons. Thanks to you lot, all this is still moving forward. They are Bradley Hope, Wizard Actual, Claire Hoffbauer, Benjamin Topper, Chongus Bongwater, Elijah Finley, Siddhartha O, Cameron Collins, Q Loves Cake Farts, Nicholas Blomberg, Matthew Diffley, Noah Schmidt, Jane Milichip, Claire, Liana, Sean Christianovich, NTG, NTHG, Arturo Rafael Macias, Ethan Zwick, Champagne Anarchist, Elise Middlefart, David McManus, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Lisa Milgram, Bradley Davies, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brennan Crave, B, Drift, Kyle Morris, RX, Tiki Lover, Cherry, Ben Marshall, Dallas Dunn, Shakir Gupta, LD50 Seattle. The LD50 Seattle, they're a fucking cool punk band. If you just look them up, LD50 Seattle, they made a song about Popular Front. It's like punk hardcore, but it's actually fucking good. Not the, you know, punk hardcore isn't good, but like they're really good. Check them out, look them up. K Glitter Vulcan, Bethany Swoveland, Adam H, Ryan Barbadillo, Derivative Fool, Paula Water, Larson 8669, Ivan Julien, Bjorn Kirsten, Diamond Steen, Michael O'Connor, Jack Doherty, Nicholas Butter, JD, Jav, James Cully, Tynan Daly, Ethan, Shanklin the Painter, Fitz Madrid, Ed Coulthard, Mike Barone, Ben, Scott Hopton, Chris Cusimano, Degenerate Zero Alpha, Giorgio Arani, DR, Trey Nance, Amy R, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Amelia Mee, Nawa Ease, Christina Rivetti, Freya Northman, Noah, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Loughran, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, Adam Bergsnyder, JL, Stephen Davila, Dan Dunham, Fletcher, Chad Walker, Diana Govanek, Lawrence Abrahams, What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick, Christopher Martin, Ryan Sandercock, and Moritz Zumwalt. Thank you all so much. Really appreciated. Patreon.com/popularfront.